and gentlemen, I'm Alfred Adisk, and this is Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188. Melody won't be here. She's involved in some shipping some product, and I'll handle the program. James Corbett will be joining me after the first break. He'll be calling in from Japan. James always has interesting, intelligent, intellectual comments, and I always look forward to talking to him. Today, gold was up $3.70 per ounce to $1,247.30. Silver was down 2 cents to $16.53 per ounce. Platinum was up $7 to $932 per ounce. Palladium was up 11 to $8.93. Crude oil was up currently 15 cents to $42.68 per barrel. U.S. dollar index is currently down 1 cent to 97.53. Dow Jones is down 57 points to 21,410. NASDAQ is up 46 points to 6,234. New York Stock Exchange is down 43 to 11,696. Standard & Poor's 500 is down 1.42, 2,435. Let's see what we've got to talk about this evening. In fact, I have to find my right script. I've got the wrong script up in front of me. There we go. Last 7 times this happened, America immediately went into a recession, and it's about to happen again. This is written by Michael Snyder at the Economic Collapse blog. He says, in part, we're getting very close to an inverted yield curve. And if that happens, a recession is essentially guaranteed. When we're talking about a yield curve, we're typically talking about the spread between 2-year bonds and 10-year bonds. Normally, the longer-term bond, the 10-year rate, is higher than the short-term rate for 2-year bonds. But when investors get spooked about the economy, this can be reversed. The result is an inverted yield curve, which means it costs more to borrow for the short-term than for the long-term. Immediately prior to the last 7 recessions, we've seen an inverted yield curve, and it looks like it's about to happen again for the very first time since the last financial crisis. On Thursday last week, the spread between the 2-year and 10-year treasuries dropped to just 79 basis points, or 0.79%. According to Business Insider, this is almost the tightest that the yield curve has been since 2007. It's another one of the leaves in the breeze, all right, that tells us, and we keep seeing them, we keep seeing the reports and evidence, not proof, but evidence, and more evidence that the stock markets are on the verge of some sort of a serious correction. In this article, the same article, they talk about rising interest rates and a slowing economy is a recipe for disaster, but the Fed has gone beyond that. It has declared that it intends to start unwinding the $4.5 trillion of assets that it accumulated on the Fed's balance sheet. What they're talking about is that the Federal Reserve has recently raised the interest rate again, and Michael Snyder says this is dangerous, he says, and truly alarming. Because the Federal Reserve should be able to see what's happening onto the yield curve, and they can see all of the other indications that the economy is slowing down, but the Federal Reserve decided to raise the interest rates anyway. Michael Snyder is arguing that they desperately want an easy, smooth, paint-drying process for raising rates in a slowing economy, but there's no chance. According to Peter Balkovar, market analyst for the Lindsay Group. He says the whole purpose of quantitative easing was to inflame the markets with higher prices, stock prices. Why shouldn't the reverse why shouldn't the reverse happen when we do quantitative tightening? And what he's trying to say is that the stock markets are going to become the shock markets. And it'll happen when there's a correction that takes place in days or hours. It won't be a slow process, which a lot of people are hoping for. He believes that the correction will be sudden, dramatic, and shocking. And again, this is evidence that our stock markets are about to become shock markets. If the Fed had not injected trillions of dollars into the system in the first place, stocks would not have gotten this high. Now that they are reversing the process that created the stock market bubble, a whole lot of innocent people out there are going to get really hurt as stock prices come crashing down. Again, stock markets are turning into shock markets. Here's an article from Matterhorn Asset Management written by Egon von Greyerz. If you follow gold at all, you'll see his name from time to time. He's located in Switzerland. He said, will gold reach $2.6 million or just $150,000? And he's talking about the price per ounce. And he's not exactly serious about these prices, but he recognized, he says these are possible. He says events might have taken a bit longer to unravel than we expected, but the trend is irreversible. Country after country will crash under the burden of debt. And this is not just the European countries, but also China, Japan, emerging markets, and of course, the United States. Who will be responsible for global liabilities of $2.5 quadrillion? All right. That's his claim that the total global debt is in the neighborhood of $2.5 quadrillion. And he's asking, who's going to be responsible? Who's going to pay that debt? And I can tell you it won't be me, and I doubt if it'll be you. He goes on and he says, we're now at a time in history when extraordinary events will be the norm. The world is currently as far from harmonious equilibrium as it has ever been in history. The masses are ultimately responsible for $2.5 quadrillion of debts, derivatives, and unfunded liabilities. None of this will, of course, ever be repaid, and that astronomical sum will grow exponentially as governments accelerate their money creation in a futile attempt to save the world. The problem we've got with the debt, as I've said repeatedly, is it appears to me, and I don't have evidence to support this, but it appears to me that in a debt-based monetary system and in a debt-based economic system, debt is not an option. Debt, more debt, is a requirement. If we don't get deeper and deeper and deeper into debt, the system is going to fall apart. The system is going to collapse. And when it does, a lot of people, some people suppose that we could just cancel the debt. All right, what would that hurt? Well, it'll hurt a lot. Because we have a debt-based monetary system. And because we have a debt-based monetary system, if there's $2.5 quadrillion worth of debts and derivatives and unfunded liabilities in the global economy, if we were to cancel that debt and just say, sorry, we can't pay the debt, aha, too bad for you, we destroy $2.5 quadrillion worth of paper debt instruments that are currently being used as collateral in banks. They're being used as savings and individual savings accounts. They're using them to fund pension funds around the world. Wipe out the debt. We have to cancel all of the bonds that memorialize that debt. And when we wipe out that paper, we wipe out those paper bonds that are being treated as assets. All of a sudden, $2.5 quadrillion in currency disappears from the global economy. It's no longer there. We depend on that paper money, right? We depend on those paper debt instruments. And yet we are now caught in a position where the debt is too great to be paid and it can't be canceled without wiping out relative paper wealth. What are we going to do? Can't pay the debt, can't cancel the debt. What is the next thing we can do with the debt? And it may be that the only thing left to do with it is just print more money and go deeper into debt. But if you do, you're going to cause inflation and probably hyperinflation, and prices for everything are going to rise dramatically, and prices for gold and silver and other monetary other monetary devices will rise even more dramatically. Since the $2.5 quadrillion in liabilities can never be repaid or run down in an orderly fashion, we will in the next few years experience a debt implosion which will be totally devastating. It is primarily the disastrous U.S. monetary policy since 1913 which has created the biggest debt mountain in history. It's not easy to illustrate the $2.5 quadrillion actually means what it actually means, but we can start with the U.S. federal debt of $20 trillion. All the gold ever produced in the world is estimated at about 170,000 tons. If the U.S. debt could be backed by gold, it would require three times more gold than what has ever been produced. That's at current prices. But if the price of gold was increased by 300%, because the requirement of three times was more gold, then the increase, and then increased by another 20 times, since the U.S. holds at most about 8,200 tons of gold, then the price of gold might have to be raised by a factor of from 60 to roughly $80,000 an ounce. Now, that's my calculation rather than Egon Vardon Greyert's. But he goes on, he said, if we were back to the gold standard rather than the fiat money with zero intrinsic value, gold would need to be worth 365 times $1,270 or $463,000 per ounce. Now, he's being, to some degree, mathematically facetious. He doesn't expect that to happen. Says that price of gold is based on all the gold in the world, including jewelry. But if we just take sovereign gold of officially 30,000 tons backing global liabilities, the gold price would have to be 5.7 times higher or $2.6 million per ounce. Well, he goes on and he does some more calculations, and he admits that, in fact, he predicts gold is most likely a price between $50,000 and $150,000 can be justified, which is, when I did the calculation myself, I came up with $80,000 an ounce. I'm in the same ballpark as von Greyert's. Is that going to happen? Don't know. Is it going to happen soon? We don't know. But it could happen. Right? And certainly you're going to see gold go to $3,000, $5,000, probably $10,000. And it could happen within the next couple of years. It's conceivable under the right circumstances it could happen. You know, it's not impossible that it could happen sometime in 2018. I'm not saying it's going to, but it's not inconceivable. The problems that we're facing with the economy of this nation, with the economy of the world, the problems are so enormous. And the problems are not just financial, they're monetary. As we've talked about on this program a number of times, the fundamental problem with this country, in my opinion and in Melody's, is that we have a fiat monetary system. We have gone from an asset-based system where the dollar was backed by gold and then by silver, and we have abandoned the gold and silver backing for the dollar, rendered it a pure fiat debt-based currency. And when we did that, we condemned our nation to a kind of national destruction. This is going to happen. There's a certain logic behind this. There's a certain inevitability, and I don't see any way they're going to maneuver around it. The debt can't be paid. All right? We have a debt-based monetary system when it seems and it appears that we need more debt and more debt and more debt, and not just a little more debt. I think when Obama doubled the debt during his 8 years in office, I don't think that was an accident. I think the debt-based monetary system required the existing debt when Obama took office in 2008, required it to be increased dramatically and perhaps doubled over the course of the next 8 years. I don't think it was an accident. I don't think it was mismanagement. I can't prove it. I could be wrong. But I think the debt has to be increased. And perhaps if I'm right, over the course of the Trump administration, assuming he's here for 8 years, he's going to have to double it again or something like that. he's going to have to at least increase it by 100%, which means we go from $20 trillion to $40 trillion in the next 8 years. And he might have to increase it by more than $20 trillion. From $20 trillion, not just plus $20 trillion, he may have to use $30 trillion, maybe even another $40 trillion to make that debt-based monetary system continue to function. And if they create that much more debt, just in the United States, it almost certainly has to translate into some serious inflation, probably hyperinflation. And in the context of at least hyperinflation, we're going to see a dramatic increase in the prices of gold and silver. All of this appears to be headed our way, and I don't see any way to get around it, although they've successfully postponed it for a number of years. Now, we talk about, we have a national debt of $20 trillion. What's that mean? It means that the government hasn't been able to pay its debts for a long time. We're not approaching a time when we can't pay our debts. We've been there for a long time. That's why we have the $20 trillion national debt. That's evidence of our inability to pay our national debt. That's why our national bills, our national debts, we wind up having to borrow $20 trillion from somebody to make good on the bills that are current. And we still owe somebody $20 trillion to pay for whatever free lunches the government is passing out, whatever roads it's building, whatever it's doing in national defense. We've had to borrow money to maintain the illusion. I've said it a number of times on the program, well, just two or three maybe, but I pointed out, look, assuming I had an automobile loan and I had to pay $1,000 a month on the automobile loan, but I can't pay it this month, and I have to get my mother, after my mother loans me the $1,000 so I can make the payment on the car. Have I paid that sum on the car, the monthly car payment? Technically, the car dealer, he's got his money. He's happy. The lender's got his money. He's happy. But if I have to borrow to make good on my bills, truth is I'm broke. We can sit back and say it's a temporary condition, but if it persists, you are basically bankrupt. And that's the real implication of the $20 trillion debt, national debt, that's owed by the government. It's evidence that it can't pay its bills without borrowing money from somebody else. And the implication is it can't pay its bills, and if that's true, then we are going to see a big problem in the near future. I'm Alfred Addisk. This is Financial Survival. We'll be back in a moment with James Corbett. Please stay tuned.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interest of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Folks, I'm Alfred Adusk, and this is Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver, 1-800-375-4188. Let me give you a special that Melody's having right now. Our special today is bullion, 1 1-ounce Canadian gold maple leaf, right, and 20 1-ounce silver buffalo rounds. The gold maple leaf bullion coin contains 1 ounce of 0.9999 fine gold. It is legal Canadian gold tender, considered to be one of the most beautiful coins in the world. The 1 ounce silver buffalo round pays tribute to America's native tribes and the buffalo. Each coin contains 0.999 ounces of fine silver, all for only $1,670. This includes your shipping and insurance. Give Melody a call, 1-800-375-4188, and ask about the current special on the Canadian gold maple leaf and 20 silver buffalo rounds. Our guest is James Corbett from thecorbettreport.com. James is a regular on the program, stops in every 2 weeks or so, and has his own blog and podcasts and whatever, and one of the most prolific voices on the internet. Hello, James. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good, and my whatever is doing pretty good, too.
Good. I've got an article from Breitbart. It says, drug overdose. This is a headline. Now the leading cause of death for Americans under 50 years of age. You have a comment on that? Does that surprise you? Does it tell you something about what's happening to society, to youth? What's going on here?
I haven't seen that story in particular, so you'll have to clue me in. And is this talking about prescription drug overdose or that evil?
I'm just reading the headline. That's all I'm reading. It's from the Department of Justice. Drug overdose, leading cause of death for Americans under 50. I would have to imagine there may be some prescription drugs included, but I'd have to imagine this is all controlled substances. Allegedly illegal drugs.
Right.
Because people under 50 aren't usually taking that much prescription medicine.
Well, I assume you're right, especially if this is coming from official sources, the CDC and whatever. They will obviously want
to.
Department of Justice. Okay. Yeah. Well, interesting. Well, I would assume that that's the gist of this story without having looked at it, but I would obviously have to look at it for more comment. But it's interesting because I'm just pulling up a story now from the Upshot New York Times, fake news, from earlier this month, talking about drug deaths in America rising faster than ever, where they say that deaths have risen 19% over the record in 2015 of 52,404 deaths. Now, let's put that number in perspective of the number of people who that is estimated of people who die in medical-related incidents, not incidents where they have a heart attack or whatever, but incidents where they are caused by prescription drug overdose of some sort.
Legal prescription drugs,
exactly.
Versus illegal drugs.
And or medical malpractice of various sorts. And I don't have that number in front of me, but I do remember, I know John Rappaport at nomorefakenews.com talks about this quite a lot because it's something that he's researched, and he pointed out a study that was done, I believe, a couple of decades ago now, but it was a really remarkable study, legit, peer-reviewed, I think it appeared in The Lancet, that estimated the number of people who died in those types of cases. I don't remember the number, but I'm sure it was in the six figures, something over 100,000 deaths per
year. I agree with it. I vaguely seem, I don't doubt for a minute that you're right about that, and it may be more than 100,000, but the point being, that more people are dying from legal drugs in this country than they are from illegal. What do you make of that?
Yes, right. Okay, well, let's just see what I'm able to find on the spot here. We have the BMJ, British Medical Journal. Medical error, the third leading cause of death in the U.S. So, again, when these types of things are highlighted, we should always put them into the bigger perspective of what they're not drawing your attention to. Oh, yes, I mean, medical error tends to be a huge contributor to deaths in the U.S., but let's focus on the latest, terror hysteria of whatever sort. And I think that's quite obvious because right now we have an administration that is seeking to clamp down harder than ever in the drug war. That's what Attorney General Jeff Sessions came into office saying he was going to do, and that's what he's pushing the Congress to allow him to do, to continue fighting the drug war against those evil, pot pushers and what have you. So, of course, I think they're going to try to highlight drug deaths. Now, that's not to downplay the idea that, street drugs and things, use may be on the rise and may be contributing to more deaths. I don't want to downplay that. I think that might be a real phenomenon, and there are probably economic reasons for that as we live through the jobless recovery era and the increasing robotization of society and, the death of the American worker, so to speak. There may be a lot to pick out from there, but I also just want to put into perspective that these types of stories generally demonize certain things at the expense of overlooking other things. And I think, prescription drugs and medical error and things like that may be something that people should be panicking about, but the Department of Justice isn't going to come out with a press release about it.
I agree. You've got to be able to read the white on the page as well as the black if you want to understand what's really going on. And we see so much news that is, it's not to give you the news. It's to give you an opinion. And I don't just mean their opinion. It's to try to persuade you to engage, to embrace the propaganda. They're telling you, not the news, they're telling you what to think, and there's a difference. Not what to observe, but what to think. And it becomes obvious. And I'm wondering, for example, CNN talked to, someone spoke up at the recent Time Warner shareholder meeting, and they said they were concerned about CNN being so prejudiced against Trump, and they were afraid it was going to hurt the value of the stock. And the spokesman for CNN said, we agree with you, and we're going to try to put an end to it. Now, the point to this peculiar little story is that maybe the mainstream media is beginning to buckle in their war against Trump. For example, another illustration of this is the idea that they had an election in Georgia yesterday that the Democrats were hopeful of winning, and they didn't. Right? They're hopeful, even though Trump's approval rating is allegedly going down, they were not able to defeat the Republican candidate down there in Georgia. And a lot of money was spent. Apparently a record amount was spent on this campaign, and still the Democrats were unable to win. And I'm wondering if this is a reaction. Do you think the American people are becoming fed up with what I perceive to be a tendency to violence and thuggery in the Democratic Party? And they're going to vote Republican regardless of what the Democrats do. Are the Democrats going too far? Are they kind of like Kathy Griffin, Griffith, where they've crossed the lines with a predisposition of violence? Have they crossed the line that they're going to have to go back across? They're going to have to go back the other way if they want to be reelected or elected to office. You understand what I'm saying? I'm fumbling for it, but do you follow what I'm saying?
No, I understand. And I think what the prudent thing to do would be to wait for the mainstream media to tell us whether or not there was any Russian hacking involved in this Georgia election.
I hadn't heard about that yet.
I'm sure it'll come up.
You're probably right. Yeah.
But at any rate, but maybe people are sick of that kind of nonsense being shoved down their throats on the basis of little evidence. Although, unfortunately, I see, well, it's difficult for me to say because here I am on the other side of the Pacific Ocean, and I don't I live in the U.S. I don't work there. I don't breathe the air. I'm not talking to people in the U.S. every day, at least not in real life. So you would have a better sense of that on the ground. But I can at least say what I can see from my online perspective, which is that I genuinely see a lot of the political left following sheep like the shepherd as they guide them towards these types of narrative explanations for what's going on. Oh, it's all the Russians, and everyone who talks about or who even floats the possibility that there could be something else going on is a Kremlin stooge. And I see it in places, for example, places like the Twitter feed of Glenn Greenwald, who I think became something of a darling of the left over the last several years, defending various Snowden and Chelsea Manning and people like that. And so now that he's questioning this, you know, Russian hacking meme, all you see is people responding to him, presumably leftists who are getting upset at him for not staying on script, as calling him a Kremlin stooge. It's kind of Alice in Wonderland. I feel like I've gone through the looking glass to see this happening in our time. We look back at the McCarthy era or something and go, oh, it's just so silly. How did people ever fall for that? And yet, here it is. It's happening. And so many people are going along with it on the basis of zero evidence. So I don't know what the reality is in terms of how many people are voting what and for what reason. From the bigger perspective, I don't think I fundamentally care. I do not care about Democrat-Republican horse races and what the left side and the right side of the same collectivist system is doing, so much as I am hoping that this might be a window of opportunity for people who care about genuine freedom to be inserting that message into this mix, rather than looking at, you know, trying to scry the tea leaves of every runoff election as to, you know, what that means for
leaves. I'm wondering if the people, what I was trying to communicate is the possibility that the American public, a lot of them, a majority of them, have perhaps hit a gag reflex based on the Democrats' propensity for violence, which has shown up since November. Trump won, and the Democrats have responded in a way that encourages, tolerates, celebrates violence. And do you think the public may have had enough of that, or is the
The public is not an entity, so. Are there leftists who are becoming disillusioned with the way the left has reacted to this? I'm sure there are, but probably not in great numbers. I think all this does is further polarize so that people on the left will further rally around their flag, and the people on the right will further get into their corner. That's all I see happening right now is further polarization. And at this particular moment, the pendulum is swung in the rightward direction towards the Republicans, but that will swing back in, you know, a decade or two or whenever. And so I don't think this is something fundamental to society that's happening right now. It's just a transitory political state. But in the end of the day, it's not going to change one thing about what's happening in Syria, for example, or what's happening with Obamacare. You know, call it Trump care, put a different layer of lipstick on the pig. It's going to be the same thing. So I don't think this is changing much about society other than, yes, I suppose the culture war is really the battlefield for American political discourse right now, more so than any policy.
Well, do you see anything, speaking of the culture war, this may be evidence of the culture war and it might not, let me see what you think about it. Do you see anything ironic in American leftists being aggravated and opposed to former communists of Russia? I mean, there is something a little bit strange here. I mean, politics not only makes for strange bedfellows, it makes for some very peculiar divorces. The leftists used to celebrate the communists of Russia, and now the former communists are their enemy.
Well, yes. Well, to be fair, I don't think the majority of people who would call themselves Democrats were necessarily celebrating the Soviet Union. There certainly were some people.
Well, I'm saying leftists. I'm not just saying Democrats, but I'm saying the leftist idea, and especially out at the radical left.
All of these terms, the public, the leftists, they're all so vague and collectivist that I don't know how to deal with that. If we could talk about specific individuals and their reactions, that might be one thing, but in the collective, it's just so I don't know if there's anything there to really get our teeth into.
Well, there's something to growl at. There might not be something to bite, but there's at least something there we can growl at, like a hologram. I've got an article here from Cointelegraph, which talks about the cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin. And the headline is, Bolivia calls cryptocurrency a pyramid scheme and arrests advocates. What do you think about cryptocurrency being labeled as a pyramid scheme?
Well, I'm just going to hold my breath and wait for them to declare fiat currency a pyramid scheme. Absolutely everything.
There's
in
good
the world.
Pyramid schemes and bad pyramid schemes.
Exactly. That's what they would say, right? Yeah. Well, like everything else in the world, value is only what people assign to it. So if people find a use for a cryptocurrency, then that is useful to them, and they will pay money, fiat money, in order to get their hands on it. Absolutely, the sort of explosion in the cryptocurrency space that we've seen over the last few months, and the hype and the craziness and the, you know, multi-million dollar coin offerings that are cropping up here and there overnight with increasing frequency is clearly a mania, a bubble of some sort. And, yep. You know, a lot of people are going to be investing in the wrong cryptocurrency and lose whatever they invest in it. That absolutely is happening. And we just saw a huge disruption of the Ethereum network. They're not able to handle the load at the moment, so there's a scaling problem that's going on that's going to affect things. So these types of problems are absolutely occurring and going to occur. I don't think that makes it a Ponzi, or it doesn't make cryptocurrency as a thing a Ponzi scheme per se. There may be individual coins that are Ponzis, but like absolutely any other investment, it's up to the investors to understand what it is they are investing in and why, rather than simply jumping on a bandwagon and hoping it'll pay off.
We've got another article from two more articles, headlines from Cointelegraph, and we've only got about 60 seconds here before we have to break. India, this goes back a couple of months. India local politicians criticize government's war on cash, Bitcoin. That's the headline. Now, they were concerned. Government is, oh my God, the Indian government is trying to get rid of cash. And they're trying to get rid of Bitcoin. And then this came out just today, Cointelegraph. Suddenly, Bitcoin to be officially legal in India. What's happened? Do we have an explanation for that? Maybe we should save it until after the break, because we've only got about 15 seconds left here. But it appears that the Indian government has been beaten into submission by cryptocurrencies. They started with a war on cash, then they said, oh, wait a second, never mind, we're going to put cash back in the system, and now they're even approving of Bitcoin. We'll talk about that when we return to Financial Survival in just a moment with our guest, James Corbett from thecorbettreport.com. Please stay tuned.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com, or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today today, complete with two Black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Adisk, and this is Financial Survival. Our guest is James Corbett from thecorbettreport.com. We're looking at a couple of headlines from Cointelegraph, which is a nice little publication that deals with cryptocurrencies. And probably, I don't know, it was six, maybe even eight months ago, that India, they tried to clamp down and eliminate the biggest denomination of Indian rupee denominations. They tried to get rid of that and force people to get their currency out of their mattresses and turn it in, and tried to get everybody on plastic. And there was a minor revolt, and they had to back off on that. And they said, okay, we're going to let you have cash. And here, Cointelegraph said, India local politicians criticized government's war on cash, Bitcoin. This was maybe 6 months ago. And then today, suddenly Bitcoin to be officially legal in India. What's happened in India? And does this offer some sort of a lesson, a guidance for the other countries in the world that are trying to get rid of cash? Can we get rid of cash?
Well, not really, because in the sense that even if you do so, there will be ways around that, and that's perhaps talked about most vividly by Larkin Rose, who has a video up on his YouTube channel. I don't remember the name of the video, but he talked about his time in prison, doing time for not paying his proper royal duties, a pound of flesh, to the U.S. government. How he was talking about the types of currencies that pop up in prison. Cigarettes or packages of cigarettes or whatever that float around us. So even in the most surveilled and controlled place you can possibly be in society, there, and with the most strict and stringent rules against, you know, the passing around of this currency, they'll find a way to make a currency out of something. And I think that's the point for larger society as a whole. As regards to the India cryptocurrency story, it's interesting the way that people think of these things versus the reality of them, because people tend to think, oh, the Indian government is going to make cryptocurrency legal. Well, that's a big boon for something like Bitcoin. Well, in fact, it's the exact opposite of what something like Bitcoin is designed for and should be for and should be thinking about. Because what it means when a government comes out and says, we're going to make this legal, is they come out and say, we're going to allow you to trade in this through exchanges. But of course, those exchanges have to be completely regulated, and anyone exchanging outside of those exchanges is now going to be a criminal. So in fact, you don't want them to quote unquote legalize it, because all they're doing is really, in fact, illegalizing the free trade and such things. And that's, I can attest to that, because in Japan, of course, it was just a couple of months ago, the government came out with their decision that finally Bitcoin is a legal currency that can be legally used in Japan, and everyone's cheering because, oh, now you're going to be able to buy things at your local store with Bitcoin and all of this. But no, actually, I mean, the first step is that all of the Bitcoin ATMs that I know of in this country have been taken offline, because now everyone who operates a Bitcoin ATM doesn't know, okay, how is this going to work now, and what do I have to, you know, what kind of ID and whatever do I have to collect from everyone in order to let them use this ATM? What are the rules now? Well, let's shut them down until we figure it all out. So it has actually made it harder for me to actually access Bitcoin here in the country when they made it legal. And I think that's the point. So that's the context in which we have to see moves like this. It's actually an attempt to clamp down. And as far as I know, the latest news that I have from moneycontrol.com is that the Indian, a source familiar with the negotiations in the Indian government, is saying that they are unlikely to actually give a legal status to Bitcoin, but they are thinking about setting up a whole other regulatory framework for them and a new agency, oversight agency, to look at them. So they're just going to make more bureaucracy without even going the step of officially making it a legal currency.
When I think about eliminating cash, it crosses my mind that part of the purpose for cash is to go visit your brick and mortar store and walk in the door. And you can, I mean, I understand that most people or a lot of people are paying with credit cards or debit cards and the rest of that. But still, cash is conducive to brick and mortar stores. If we got rid of cash, would that have an adverse impact on brick and mortar stores? Do you think, would it be significant? Or do we see more brick and mortar stores closing down? Because once we get rid of cash and we do everything with plastic, then why do I want to drive down to the brick and mortar store? I can look for whatever I want to buy on the internet. And I can have it ordered and have it delivered, and if you really want it, you can have it in 24 hours. Maybe a couple of days, you can have what you need, and you don't have to spend any gasoline, turn the car on. What I'm trying to get to is, does the value of commercial real estate in this country, at least for retail stores, do you think it depends at all on the presence of cash, or does it make no difference whether you go cash or credit or whatever?
Well, I see what you're saying. I don't think it necessarily means the end of retail business as we've known it, but clearly there is a rise in online retail and a decline in brick-and-mortar retail, and that is related to the ease of online electronic transactions and the various, you know, plastics and whatever that people pay with these days. So there is a relation there, although I don't know if it's quite so causal or if that's a primary causal factor in what's going on right now. And if that was the only issue, then I wouldn't even necessarily have a problem with that. It is easier to shop from home and, you know, whatever. Yep. So it's just a change. Just as 100 years ago, you know, the catalog companies were a big thing. Well, no one buys from catalogs anymore, but now we do the 21st century equivalent. We buy online. So it's not something that I would worry about. I mean, the real issue here, though, is the anonymity. The idea that you can just go to someone and hand them some paper that the government never has to know that exchange took place unless you tell them. So that's really the issue here. And of course, that is why ultimately all of these governments are making cash the demon, the enemy that has to be combated.
Do you think that Bitcoin or any of the rest of the cryptocurrencies can provide real anonymity?
Pseudonymity, and they can be used more or less intelligently. It's probably never going to get to the point where your average tech clueless person can just pick up a new cryptocurrency wallet and start using it in a pseudonymous fashion that will never be traceable. I mean, that's a bit of a pipe dream. Can it exist as a way that if you used properly, people can more or less get around the kind of restrictions that are being placed on cash? I think it is feasible, but it will be legally circumscribed, and that type of activity will be made illegal, and you will technically be a criminal, and you'll have to act as one, and you'll be operating in black markets if you choose to go that route, and the stigma attached to that will still exist in the future. So like everything else, there's always ways around the system, but it's always generally something that's difficult to do, and if you get caught and the authorities find you doing something you shouldn't be doing, you can be put in the slammer for years. And I think that's a disincentive enough that most people will just go along with the system to get along. So I think there is some degree of pseudonymity that can be attained with these types of coins, but it's extremely difficult to do properly, technologically properly, and that's probably not something that most people would want to do anyway.
Well, the question is, how many people who'd use Bitcoin, for example, can the government go after in a particular year? For example, I know that the government only files about 1,000, or at least they did. This was true. The numbers were true a few years ago. The government only files about 1,000 criminal charges every year. The IRS files only about 1,000 criminal charges, and typically there's two or three charges for each defendant, which means they're only charged criminally 300-400 people a year. And that number might be up, but to what? Maybe 1,000 people a year get charged criminally by the IRS? They don't have the resources to go after everybody who is actually violating the income tax laws. Are they going to have the resources to go after? They criminalize Bitcoin, for example, but will they have the resources to go after everybody who uses Bitcoin? Or will the numbers simply be so big that, you know, it's like putting one guard on the border and letting and putting them in charge of stopping the next 500 illegal aliens who pour across the border.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I, exactly as you indicate there with that analogy, the point is often what they choose to prosecute and what they don't.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
That can certainly make people act in different ways. I think what results in the coming year or two in terms of Bitcoin in the United States and the way the government acts on it will determine whether or not more people pick it up and start using it, and then how feasible it would be to prosecute everyone in that space. Presumably just like tax avoidance or whatever, only a certain amount of people are ever going to be audited in any given year, and you know, you can get away with something more or less for a number of years before it catches up or blah blah blah. But, I mean, there are some pretty worrying precedents that are being set right now. In fact, just last year, the IRS requested the personal data of all Coinbase users. That's a specific type of Bitcoin exchange that operates in the United States. The IRS requested all the personal data on all the registered users of Coinbase for any transaction between 2013 and 2015, and a San Francisco federal judge approved that request. A pretty remarkably broad-based request for information, but it is apparently proceeding. I haven't seen the latest updates on that. That's a few months old now, but still, that's a pretty amazing precedent that's being set, and certainly the implication is that if and when they really do want to clamp down or want to completely regulate what's going on, they will have the federal, you know, court case precedent in order to do that and to basically make everyone who doesn't comply a criminal. And again, it's always a question of whether, you know, to what extent they prosecute and in what ways. But if they want to start making examples of people, they probably have the data in order to do that now.
I read a copy of the United States Attorney's newsletter, monthly newsletter, back in the 1990s. And they were interviewing an attorney for the IRS, and they asked him what was the basis of selecting people for criminal prosecution. He said flat out, he said, the reason we identify certain groups, individuals, and they are selected for prosecution based on the impact they're going to have on the public. In other words, it's not an accident that they go after, I can't even think of her name, the Queen of Mean, operated Leona Helmsley. All right, they went after her because she had a big name. They got more publicity by going after her than they would for going after some small operator. They went after an airline pilot when they knew that the airline pilots in general, that occupation, was routinely cheating on their income tax. They went after one airline pilot with the intent of brutalizing him, all right, in order to show the rest of them, you better play ball. Selective prosecution purpose is to deter, scare the, you know, the whatever out of people in that class. That doesn't strike me as evidence of government power. It strikes me as evidence of government desperation. We've got to pick somebody who's really important. Wesley Snipes, for example, movie actor.
Mm-hmm.
We'll go after Wesley and we'll hang him. All right?
Exactly.
And that'll scare.
Yeah.
If we can get Wesley or
Muhammad Ali or whoever.
Willie Nelson.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
If we can get
course,
him, you know,
yeah,
we can get you or me.
Exactly. Make an example and make
yep.
a. But yeah, and you're right. Of course, it does show fundamentally actually the weakness of the system
yep.
rather than its strength.
Yep.
And it's the old ants analogy. There are millions of us and only a few of them. Why do we let them control us? But it's exceptionally powerful and it's effective from a psychological perspective. They yeah. They have done their research on the human organism enough to know how to push the right buttons and how to get people to fall in line. And unfortunately, it's worked for a very long time.
Down to where we've got about 2 minutes left. What if people don't fall in line? For example, Seth Rich, a staffer for the Democratic National Committee, was murdered. Probably now 6 weeks ago, I don't know, a month or 6 weeks ago, was in contact with WikiLeaks. Are you familiar with that? Have you followed that conspiracy theory at all? They think this wasn't an accident done by the government itself.
I am familiar with it. I haven't devoted a great deal of research to it, but yes, I am familiar with the theory.
And do you think there's going to be a fire under all this smoke? Or do you think the smoke is going to be quenched, drowned out, washed away, and we'll forget about Seth Rich here in the next, who knows?
Yeah. Well, I'm sure there is.
Will it be forgotten or will it drag on forever?
I'm sure there is some fire behind the smoke. But the question, as always, is will they plant a false fire for people to discover if that's not extending the analogy too much, i.e., you know, a false trail leading towards false conclusions that people come to, and then they show, no, that's completely wrong, and thus we've debunked the entire thing and now go away, which is, I think, a psyop tactic that's worked a lot in the past with these types of conspiracy theories. So I think people have to be very careful with things like this, because a lot of false trails get planted in these types of stories as well to lead people down the wrong rabbit holes. So I wouldn't want to discourage anyone from investigating these types of things, but let's take every piece of information with a grain of salt. And the best thing we can do in any situation, conspiracy theory or otherwise, is to try to disprove what it is that we believe. And if we really put our beliefs to the best test that we can, and they still are standing, then that's good. That's great. And if you put it to an honest test and you can't, it starts to fall, then it might be time to rethink what it is you believe. And that's difficult to do. Easier said than done, but it's really important for everyone.
I think most people, it's not just a question of rethinking what you believe, it's rethinking who you believe. Because
or why people, you believe it. Yeah.
Or why you believe it. Because we tend to just believe somebody. We believed Walter Cronkite back in the day. Who do we believe? We need to actually do our own thinking is what we're talking about, and I'm sure you agree with that, and not too many people do. We're out of time, James. I want to thank you very much for being on the program. Look forward to talking to you again in 2 weeks. I'm Alfred Adisk. This is Financial Survival. Melody and I will be back tomorrow. In the meantime, the good Lord bless you, me, Melody, Todd the producer, and James Corbett. Bye-bye.
I have to pay. Payment's sad. And still there never seems to be a single penny left for me. That's too bad.